Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Movie Geeks United. Tonight, actor Robert Forrester and director James Houser talk about Calamity. To the show, Movie Geeks United is on the air. I am Jamie.
And I am Jerry, and we're delighted to bring this show to you.
How are you doing tonight, man?
I'm doing pretty good. I can't wait to hear this interview with Robert Forrester, Max Cherry himself, so I'm very excited.
Yeah. You're talking about, you know, in Robert Forrester, one of the veteran character actors
mm-hmm.
that had this third act resurrection from Tarantino
mm-hmm.
that he really took advantage of, and he's worked with some high-profile directors throughout his career. So,
yeah. Early on, wasn't it Reflections of a Golden Eye or the one with Marlon Brando? And
yeah,
wow.
I mean,
that wasn't that his first big breakthrough? Or
you know, there's so many movies to talk to him about, and
yeah.
so many figures that he's worked with. We only kind of scratched the surface with
mm-hmm.
him, but we do cover Lynch, we do cover Tarantino, and he has a great John Huston story. His first movie was under the direction of John Huston.
Mm-hmm.
And also Calamity, which is a new film written and directed by James Houser, who will join us at the end of the show tonight. And he plays, he co-stars in that film. It also stars Nick Stahl and Jonathan Jackson, their two best friends, both suffering from a breakup, their own breakup, in different ways. And
yeah.
it's kind of about the extremes of what romantic heartbreak can do to you and how it can strain a friendship, a close friendship, and your relationships with everyone else in your life.
Right.
So we're pleased to be able to welcome on both of those talents from that film. So we're going to, a little bit later, we're going to be talking about the new movies that opened up this weekend, mainly Hereafter, the new Clint Eastwood film, and Paranormal Activity 2.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure to the surprise and shock and delight of everyone, I've actually seen Paranormal Activity 2. I've actually gone to the theater and watched a film this week. It was refreshing. So that conversation takes place a little later. Did you see the weekend box office, how movies did this weekend?
Yeah, Paranormal Activity did extremely well. Hereafter came in at number four, but I actually think that's pretty good, considering the subject matter and everything. And that's a platform release because that had it played, I think, limited release on the week before. So.
Okay. And so I don't have them up. I'm trying to bring them up now. But just to give you guys out there an indication, the first Paranormal Activity was obviously a major indie endeavor,
mm-hmm.
Created for $10,000, and it went on to be the highest grossing film in relation to cost of all time.
Mm-hmm.
This one, they really stuck to the roots of it. This is under $3 million, this production. Because obviously they had unions involved and that kind of thing. But we can talk about the content and how closely it follows the original Paranormal Activity.
It made $41.5 million.
Yeah.
If that was that's a great return on investment. So
what surprises me, though, and we saw the same thing with Jackass 3D last weekend,
mm-hmm.
because Jackass pulled in about $20 million on Friday last
mm-hmm.
week, just like Paranormal Activity 2 did this weekend. So that tells me that for those types of youth-driven films, the opening night is the big one. A lot of times you'll see a good gross on Friday, even more on Saturday. and then a little less than Friday on Sunday. But mm-hmm. That doesn't happen these past 2 weeks with Jackass and Paranormal Activity 2.
Right. No, you're right. Let me ask you this, though. Do you think, because this weekend, the Halloween weekend, is really what everyone has been looking forward to for the last year, where Paranormal faces off against the reigning champion of this previous weekend, was supposedly the last Saw movie.
Mm-hmm.
I think Saw will be number one. I can't imagine it not being, with the 3D, with the added 3D component. But I'm curious to see how Paranormal Activity holds up, if it holds up. I'm not sure it will. I have no idea.
Yeah. I mean, that's the ace in the hole for Saw.
Mm-hmm.
I think they were probably smart to make it in 3D so they get the higher ticket price. Because they want to be armed with as much as they can be to go
mm-hmm.
up against a second weekend of Paranormal Activity. I think Paranormal Activity will stay strong, maybe at a little less than half the gross.
Yeah, I think
and,
so.
Yeah, because Jackass came in second with 21.5. I mean, that Jackass 3D in 2 weeks is an $87 million grossing movie.
For what many have called a tired franchise, I'd love a tired franchise that would make $87 million.
Yeah, and that would be substantially less if it were not in 3D.
Oh, you're absolutely right.
Obviously.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the higher ticket price and because
yeah.
it's the kind of gimmick to get them in there. Because my
mm-hmm.
understanding, you said it, 3D really does nothing for it.
Yeah, you didn't need to put it in 3D. I can enjoy the, pain of all these men without the 3D. It might have been actually more enjoyable, actually, had I not experienced it in 3D, because it does hurt. The sympathy scenes are there. It's a fun movie. I mean, there's no doubt about it. I mean, the funny thing about Jackass is you talk to a lot of people who you would never think would even go see that movie, like serious people, and everyone likes Jackass. There's something cathartic about watching people, I guess, hurt themselves, because it's not you, it's them. Hey, more power to them. They're going through this, and
yeah, they're for the grace of God.
Mm-hmm.
That is interesting. Actually, next weekend, next Sunday night, we'll have Gail Ann Hurd, mega producer. She's going to be on to talk about The Walking Dead, which premieres next Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
And also next Sunday, I'll have reviews of two new films ahead of release. I'm actually going to the movies a lot more now.
Yeah, I mean, one of them is Unstoppable, right?
Unstoppable and Love and Other Drugs. So I'm going
to
go check those
really
out next week.
That's the one I'm really looking forward to. I can't wait to see that one.
So you guys will get an advance word on those films. Finally,
okay,
I feel like I'm in with the human race here.
Oh, you're beyond me. You're way ahead of the curve with these. I mean...
And then next week we have a special horror movie series featuring some of our archived interviews and some brand new interviews. Tomorrow night we'll look into Psycho, Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho, and the subsequent sequels. And then Tuesday night, Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Wednesday, The Blair Witch Project. Thursday, a general overview of the state of the horror genre. So those will be available each night. Around 10 and 11 o'clock, you'll be able to upload them and listen into them. So I'm sure you guys will enjoy those.
Mm-hmm.
And we're still hard at work on our Kubrick series, and we'll have details about that series in the coming weeks when we come out with a guest list and content outline and that whole thing. So
I
look forward to that.
I think the Kubrick series deserves its own special just show about the making of the Kubrick series.
Right. I think so. I think we're shooting for a Webby.
Definitely. Oh, absolutely.
The Webby Award. Speaking of which, before we play Robert Forster here, I guess I misspoke. Dean, our loyal listener and New York correspondent, brought it to my attention. The last show, I think we're both very tired.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I suffered a death in my family just that day, and it wasn't the best of shows. So
right.
I misspoke, and I said. That David Lynch is irrelevant. I didn't mean that necessarily, because Dean brought to my attention, he said, look, he's not irrelevant. He just won a Webby Award for his interview series, and his mind is still busy on many, many things. Irrelevant was the wrong word. The David Lynch I love hasn't been around for a long time, mm-hmm. and the fact that he won a Webby Award illustrates that to me, because he's consumed with making web-quality content and shooting feature films in the cheapest possible format, not even digital. I mean, like, a $600 digital camera, and you're talking about one of the great visualists of all time.
Mm-hmm.
Sumptuous his movies are. They're atmospheric experiences that stay with you. So I miss that David Lynch.
Right.
He's gone.
I knew what you meant. I knew exactly what you meant.
I mean, I'm as crazy about David Lynch as the next guy.
Mm-hmm.
If the next guy's you.
No, but it's very important to bring that up, though, actually, because, you know, for you, one of the transformative movies is Wild at Heart. That's your movie. That's the game changer for you. And that will never change.
Yeah. No, it won't. No, that's stay with me, definitely. Okay, Robert Forrester, we all know him, we love him, and everything from Jackie Brown to Alligator. I mean,
I love Alligator.
Yes, absolutely.
My dad hated that movie. He almost kept trying to turn it off when that first came on TV. So.
Man, I remember as a kid that was a favorite. I mean,
yeah.
It was playing on cable all the time, and we always watched it. It was something else. He's had such a long, distinguished career, and I'm happy to report he is absolutely one of the nicest people I've ever had the pleasure of talking to. I mean, just an absolute gentleman and so genuine. So here is Robert Forrester talking about some of the extraordinary collaborations he's had throughout his career and his new film Calamity, which is written and directed by James Housler and is currently in limited release.
I can't do this right now, Alice. Barbie House Ken.
I've said it. Father said it to me. If it's meant to be, love will find a way.
Hey, Alice. Please just hear me out.
I don't think we should talk.
Hey.
I can feel you obsessing.
I can't stop.
We all make rash decisions. Is that what happened to you, Billy?
Hello, I'm Stan.
Ashley.
Oh, Ashley.
Don't say that name.
You're my friend at best, Eileen. I'm not even sure you can handle that.
See, Ashley has been hard at work. Catch up with you later. Hanging out with a doormat.
What if something happened to Alan?
What did you say?
Would you be heartbroken?
I don't want to be like him. I don't want to feel what he's feeling.
Where is he? I'm not sure he can come back from. Subconscious rip. Animalistic rage.
You're lying to your best friend's face!
Searching in for a young woman of 24. She has not been seen for
2 days. You hear me? We're friends. You're making me feel crazy here, Stan.
You think you're crazy?
No. I can fix what
I'm doing. What is this man?
So tell me about your first reaction when you received the script for Calamity.
Well, I know James Housler, James. I did a picture with him several years ago, so I knew him. And he said, look, I don't have anything for you in this movie, but there's the part of the father of the guy. He said, would you be willing to come to Virginia and shoot it? It'll take about 6 hours. I said, well, of course I would. So, this is not a big part in his movie, but I was in his other movie, one of his other movies, called Wild Seven. And and that movie was shot in Arizona 2 or 3 years ago with a couple old pals of mine, Richard Roundtree and Robert Loggia. We play three crooks looking to knock over a bank, and it turns out that my son... and his gang of ne'er-do-wells are trying to knock off the same bank. And at the end of the movie, we encounter each other, guns pointed at each other, trying to rob the same bank. So that was Wild 7. And when he said, can you come to Virginia for one day of shoot, I said, by all means, tell me when. And I went there. And as I saw in the production notes, it was raining, and it rained and rained until I left.
But obviously, you have a rapport with Mr. Hausler. Tell me about that working relationship and what you respond to with him.
You know, he's an interesting guy and a very nice guy. He's not a Hollywood guy at all. He's quiet and, you know, a little on the shy side. He reminds me of David Lynch, and his movies are a little like David Lynch. They're quiet and slow, and once you get into the rhythm of his movie, you realize these characters are believable people, saying believable things. They aren't movie people pushing a plot. When I started in this business, you know, in 1964 and 5, lines of dialogue were meant to push plot. The actor had to take a line, and the director would sometimes say, see what you can do with this line, you know. And it was meant to get all the information possible in a short spurt and move the story forward. This movie is not like that, or David Lynch's for that matter, or even Clint Eastwood, who also makes slow, deliberate movies. Once you get into the rhythm of them, however, you're in for a nice ride. And this picture, Calamity, is I don't know whether you're spilling the story or not, but this is about something that almost every guy I've ever known has had to deal with, and women too, but I know more about it from the guy's side. This is a movie about heartbreak. And
sure.
Getting dumped by a girl, or losing the girl, or being sad about the girl, and how different people react to that. And here you've got two very different reactions to having been dumped or losing the girl in this movie, Calamity. And you know, it's real on a lot of fronts. You probably also know it's opening tomorrow in New York and Los Angeles.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
And you mentioned it's a movie about broken relationships and the heartbreak that can cause, mainly from the male perspective. And we've seen a lot of films on that subject matter, but nothing like this, nothing quite told in this way. So he seems to be a very outside of the box filmmaker.
He certainly is. And when you look at, as I said, for instance, David Lynch, you look at his early movies, or even, you know, any of them, they take their time and tell you a story and give you an opportunity to warm into it and understand it. And at the end of this movie, I was very glad that James, in the voiceover, there's a tiny voiceover that starts at the beginning and touches us at the end, and he reminds us that the ways in which we deal with pain defines us as a human being. And these two guys, each in his own way, respond to the pain of the loss in quite different ways, as you know. You've seen the picture.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great film. You were talking about the dialogue, and the dialogue not necessarily being crafted to just propel plot points.
Yeah.
As in Lynch's work. Does that allow you a certain freedom as an actor?
Now, I worked with David Lynch in Mulholland
Absolutely.
Drive.
Yeah.
And I must admit that when I read the script, now, when I read it and shot it, it was a pilot for one of his interesting, odd television shows. You remember the other one, Twin Peaks?
Twin Peaks, yes, sir.
Well, what do I want to say about Twin Peaks? You didn't know where it was going. And neither did we when I read the script of Mulholland Drive. So it was a pilot for a television show. Later, of course, when it didn't succeed as a television show, when it didn't get picked up, they shot some additional material and made it into a standalone movie. But when I shot it, I didn't understand it, nor did I understand where it was going. All I knew was that I was a detective in a situation, and I only shot, a couple of days, couple of half days, couple of half nights. And on my first shooting night, we were on a road, maybe in Griffith Park, above Los Angeles, with all of the beautiful lights of Los Angeles spread out before us. And I walked from the scene of an accident over to the edge of the other side of the road, and I look over Los Angeles, and I say some lines, and I can't remember who I'm talking to at this moment, but I did the scene, and, you know, I have a feeling for the rhythm of a believable line of dialogue, and I did my line. And David said after the shot, he says, do it slower. And I thought, okay, I can do it slower, and I did it slower. And on the following take, he said, do it slower still. Now I'm beginning to think, what is this guy asking me to do? Because it's not sounding real anymore. It's sounding something else. I finally did the line slower than I can imagine or than I would ever imagine saying a line without saying to a director, hey, guess what? This doesn't sound real to me. I can't do it like that. But this is David Lynch. And I said, okay, Bob, give him the line the way he wants it. Eventually, I realized that this scene was not a real scene, but was in a dream, something I didn't know on the set. And going with the director, this is a good director, you know, that's when I said to myself, hey, Bob, don't second-guess the director. This guy knows what he's doing. And finally, when I realized that I was in a dream sequence, then the line, the slowness of the line made sense. But he didn't expose that to me until after the movie was released as a standalone movie. So did you actually
shoot more than that initial scene that ended up in the movie? Did you shoot more for the pilot?
Yes, and I can't remember what all stayed in the movie, but if it had gone as into series, he said that he'd, you know, find out when I wasn't working on something else, because at that time I was working a lot. This was right after Jackie Brown, and I had a lot of stuff going on. You know, things cool off after a while, but at that point he said, you'll come in and we'll shoot little scenes, and that'll be my part of the television show. So I was delighted, and this is a guy that I liked long before and was dying to work with. And so anyway, he was extremely nice to me, David Lynch, and working with him reminds me a little bit of working with James Housler. They're both deliberate, they're both quiet, they're both reserved, and they ask you to do something and you think, this guy knows what he wants. Let's give it to him. But I had very little to do in Calamity. Had a lot more to do in Wild 7.
Mm-hmm. Now, we're talking about writing and different styles of writing. And obviously you mentioned Jackie Brown, which is the biggie from from this act of your career.
It's biggie. It's my biggie, I'll tell you.
Yeah. And that Tarantino's dialogue seems... I mean, it obviously is its own music. It has a rhythm all of its own. So that must be a kind of a different monster altogether to tackle. I mean, that has to pretty much be exact as written to not miss any of the poetry.
It's very possible that Ordell's killed somebody. You realize that?
Well, I ain't going back to jail. And I ain't doing that probation thing again. Max, how do you feel about getting old?
You're not old. You look great.
No, I'm asking you, how do you feel about getting old? Doesn't it bother you?
It's not really something I think about.
Really?
Oh, I guess I got a little sensitive about my hair a few years ago. It started falling out, so, I did something about it.
How do you feel about that?
I feel fine with it. Otherwise, I wouldn't have done it. I did it to feel better about myself, and, I do. Look in the mirror, looks like me.
Yeah, but it's different for men.
You know, I can't really feel too sorry for you in this department. I bet that except for possibly an afro, you look exactly the way you did at 29.
Well, I think the same.
Bigger?
Yeah.
Ain't nothing wrong with that. Something else worry you?
I always feel like I'm starting over. How many bonds you said you wrote?
15,000.
Is that a lot?
It's plenty.
Well, I've flown over 7 million miles and I've been waiting on people for 20 years. And after my bust, the best job I could get was with Cabo Air, which is the worst job you could get in this industry. You know, I make $16,000 a year plus retirement benefits that ain't worth a damn. And with this arrest hanging over my head, Max, I'm scared. And if I lose this job, I gotta start all over again, and I ain't got nothing to start over with. I'll be stuck with whatever I can get. And that shit is more scary than Ordell.
Quentin Wright is a master of dialogue. He hears it. He hears it in his mind. And there was very little room for improvisation in that movie. But that didn't mean that I was constrained in any way, because he wrote this thing so well that. And the way I work on dialogue, I take the script and I read the lines and I try to understand the scene. I try to understand what place this scene has in the movie. You know, there's some detective work, but eventually you put the script down and you try to say the line the way you think you remember the line in the script, and then you go back to the script and see how close you got to the way the guy wrote it. Well, this guy writes material so well that the way you'd phrase something, is the way it's written. This guy is so good. We're talking about Tarantino. So whereas there were no real opportunities for improvisation, I needed none, because this guy's dialogue is so good. The only moment in the movie that I can remember, maybe there were others, but the only moment that I can remember in the movie was the very last scene when Pam Grier comes to my office and we kiss. And she is about to leave, and she wants me to go to Spain with her. And I am sort of trying to make up my mind whether I dare leave my office and run away with this woman. And the phone rings. Now, it wasn't in the movie. It wasn't in the script. But while we're shooting that, Quentin says to me, "There'll be a moment in your office when the phone will ring. Pick it up." And there was a moment when the phone rang. And I picked it up, and I improvised what was going on in that telephone call. I pictured some woman whose son was in trouble, and I asked her how old the kid was, maybe, and does he live at home, or is there a father at home? I can't quite remember, but that was improvised. There was just a moment in the movie where, but other than that, Quentin Tarantino writes masterfully, and I know that he wrote it with me in mind, and so, you know, it sort of conformed to me easily.
Yeah, well, you're fantastic in that. You're fantastic in everything. I've loved watching you over the years. Your work means a lot to me as a, you know, obviously a movie geek that I am.
It's great to be overrated, Jamie.
No, you're not overrated. I just have one more question for you. You've been doing this for a long time, and I'm wondering if acting means something different for you now than it did when you were starting.
Well, when I was starting, I had no idea that there were a zillion of us and a very small number of jobs. I went to New York City in 1964 thinking, how hard could it be? Kids can do it. And so I went to New York without knowing the amount of competition there was. ignorance was my friend. Now I seem to know how much competition there is, and so that element is different from when I first started. The other thing, I guess, is that it's become a job. I understand the needs of production. I try very hard to exceed to the needs of production. You know, they've got to get a certain amount of work done every single day. They have a finite number of shots that got to get done. And I, by the amount of experience that I've had, know how to help them get it. In the beginning, it was a lot less understandable to me, but people helped me. I had a great director in the first guy, John Huston, and from there, you know, it was a learning experience, and it continues to be. Every single shot is an opportunity to deliver the best you got at that moment. And so it continues to be what it was at the very beginning, an opportunity to do your very best.
You mentioned John Huston and David Lynch and Mr. Hausler and Tarantino, and you worked with the greats. And I'm curious, is there a single most valuable lesson you've learned from any of these giant directors?
John Huston told me when I was doing the wardrobing, I said, when I was doing the wardrobing, he said to me, I told him I had never done a movie. This is prior to doing any picture. And it was on the phone. It wasn't wardrobing. When I was on the phone with him after he gave me the job and the agents arranged a telephone call, and I said, now, I appreciate the fact that you hired me. I said, but do you remember I told you I never did a movie? He says, I remember. I said, well, and reading my mind at the other end of the telephone, he says, I'll give you some instruction. And so for months, I expected this guy to give me some instruction. And it wasn't until the day we started the movie, after telling me, yes, wait, I'll give it to you. But eventually, on the first day of production, I got out of the car. They drove me to the set. And as I get out of the car, John Huston says, now's the time, Bobby. I said, shoot, I'm all ears. He says, go take a look through the lens. And I walked over to the camera. The cameraman stepped aside. I looked through the lens at the scene that we were about to shoot. And I turned back to Huston. He had his hands formed the way, you know, a guy shows you how, with the frame lines, you know, sort of a box with his fingers. And he said, you see those? Those are the frame lines. And I looked back through the lens and I said, you mean that the line that shows the cameraman what the audience sees? He says, yes, those are the frame lines. Now, ask yourself this. What needs to be there? He made me realize that it wasn't only one thing that I had to know, but I had to understand how the writer wanted the material to be, what the writer intended for me, and what I was supposed to deliver in that scene. And in addition to that, the director has some instructions for me so that when the guy says action, I need to do what the director needs of me. In addition, the one who set the lights wants me to be in them. Or the one who, the word's got to be correct. Otherwise, at the end of the shot, the sound guy says, no good for sound, start again. Or if I put the cup in the wrong spot, somebody says, no good for continuity, start again. Or if I do something too big for the shot I'm in, the guy behind the lens says, no good for composition, start again. I realize from John Huston's remark that that everybody on that set is your boss, and you need to deliver something to everybody on that set, including the editor, who you need to know how the ups and downs of this movie go, what the roller coaster track looks like of this movie, so that going down and going up and going around the terms, you can contribute to the editor's needs and to the audience's needs, who need to believe what's going on. Otherwise, they'll fly out going around the corner if they don't believe what's going on. And for the one who hired me, the producer, I got to help bring this movie in on time. I need to be ready to deliver on that first or second or the third take, So you owe something to everybody on that movie, and it was contained in John Huston's original piece of information, the original piece of advice to me, which was take a look through the lens and see that frame line and ask yourself what needs to be there. This guy gave me a real big hint right at the top of my career.
Well, it's true. There are so many balls you have to manage and balance up in the air. Does it become easier for you, the actual technicality of giving a performance?
Well, look, you know, judging from the fact that there are actors I know who I wouldn't trust with a grocery list who can do those things, they'll keep those balls in the air, do that 8 days a week. It couldn't be that hard. But you get better and better understanding quicker what you can do to be helpful. And so, as I said earlier, I think the years of experience have given me, what with to help movie makers to get their shots, because that's what this business is. It's a business of making movie shots, so many a day, and then letting the guy cut them together and make a movie that he wanted to make.
Absolutely. I can't thank you enough for giving me your time today. I'm just a huge admirer of your work, and let's do this again. I'd love to talk to you sometime in the future.
Jamie, you got my undivided attention. I thank you very much for yours.
All right, that's actor Robert Forster. The movie is Calamity, and it's currently in limited release.
That was a great interview. He sounds so down to earth. That was really, just really great questions from you. That was really wonderful.
Well, I mean, obviously, he was what made it great. I mean, he's just so forthcoming. But
yeah, but he was so into it, and I always appreciate that. But it was really good questions from you, too. So,
well, he called in. I'll tell you how this went, because this is interesting, and then I'll bring Chris on.
Okay.
Contrary to popular opinion, we don't make our living off the show. So
we really don't. I wish I did.
We all have day jobs. So I was at my day job. I was completely prepared to interview Robert Forster that afternoon when I wasn't at my day job. So I get an email that said that we're going to have to move it to tomorrow a few hours earlier. So I was thinking I'd have to give it to Aaron, one of our co-hosts, who doesn't have a job.
But we love Aaron, though.
We love Aaron
because he saved us so many times.
And that sounded like a negative remark. I didn't.
But it's
mean
not.
It to.
We really do love Aaron, and he has saved our hide so many times.
He's terrific for us. So I said, okay. Apparently, the email was sent the night before, so tomorrow was the same day. It was just a couple of hours earlier. So I constantly check my email, and I got an email that said, I'll be calling in with Robert in 10 minutes. And I'm in the middle of the office where I work, so I very quickly scheduled a show, and then I borrowed someone's cell phone. So I obviously didn't have anything prepared with me because it was here at the house for later that day. And I interviewed him spur of the moment within the next 5 minutes after I found out from the parking lot of my work.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a little nervous, but he called in a couple of minutes before the recording started. So he said, that's fine. If you want to sit here and chat, or if you want me to sit here in silence until it starts recording, I can go either way. And I mean, just a gentleman throughout the entire interview. And the publicist actually said that when he went in to do press with her that day, because she organizes all the interviews that take place that day, he actually brought her a present. So she was like, no one's ever done that for me.
Yeah, no, he's a good guy. Before we bring Chris on, I just want to make some I want to, first of all, one of our most loyal listeners, Jet Noir, it's her birthday today, so I want to wish her a happy birthday.
Oh, I wish I had music for her.
And I want to wish, because she's been just a great supporter of everything we do. So happy birthday, Jet. And
happy
I'd
birthday.
Like,
you should sing. You should sing to her.
I can't sing because that would destroy our loyal listener base. I don't want to do that. But I'd also like to welcome for the Stacy, Tammy, and Lucas, who have been friends of mine on Facebook and MySpace for a long time, and I just like to, this is the first time I think listening to the show, or at least that I know that they're listening to the show, and they're in the chat room, and I just like to thank them very much for joining us tonight. It means a lot to all of us, so thank you for taking the
time.
Yes.
Thank you. To all of our new live listeners and all of our new archive listeners, and of course all the old group too. You guys are all appreciated by
us. Yeah, we love
as is Chris, who's on the line. Hey, buddy.
Yeah, he's the man.
Hey, what's up, fellas?
Hey, how you doing, Chris?
I'm doing great. Doing great.
Good.
Just listening to Robert Forster, who's a hell of a sweetheart sounding guy.
Yeah,
I know. It makes you like, you know what? And you know what I found on YouTube the other day is his deleted stuff from the Mulholland Drive pilot. Apparently that's on YouTube.
Yeah, that's one of those sort of performances that's famous not for what it is, but for what it isn't or didn't get a chance to be, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's interesting. So you can see those online?
Yeah, there's a long scene in his office talking to another detective, and they have several clips from the pilot on YouTube.
Mm.
I mean, because it's mystifying, because here's Robert Forster, and he shows up for a couple of lines of dialogue in one of the opening scenes in the first 10 minutes of the film, and you don't see him again. But
It was
it's
sort of
first,
on the
It's not the first
the
thing about David Lynch's movies that are mystifying, by the way.
No. Certainly not.
Yeah, and of course he was also in Medium Cool, which is a great movie. And Karen Sisko, which is a show that should have survived.
He played the Dennis Farina part, right?
The father
of Karen
Sisko. He was
great in that. He was wonderful in that show.
And she was perfect for it. I wish that show had gotten a chance. But
me too.
All right, Chris, you've seen a movie this weekend. I've seen a movie this weekend. Jerry, of course. Mm. Always
yeah, I mean, yeah, well, that goes without saying. I mean, but I...
So let's,
talk about Hereafter,
yeah, because, Chris, you saw Hereafter, so let's hear you and Jerry spar over that right now.
Spar over it? Wow.
he's trying to create rating, Chris. Rating.
He's what?
Rating.
Oh, he's
create
rating. Yeah, you can't create a disagreement between Jerry and I. It rarely happens, but when it does, it's always by surprise.
I think we both feel the same way about this, though.
If Martin Landau had turned it down, I'm sure we would have had an argument about it.
Yeah, well, that would be. It's very easy to predict when you and I will have. I went and saw Hereafter because my wife strangely wanted to see it. It's not the kind of movie that she'd normally want to see, but, well, let's be honest, she wants to fuck Matt Damon, so...
I thought about that during the movie.
Yeah. No, and I love Matt Damon, too, and I love Eastwood, and I thought the movie looked interesting, and I thought it was really, really good. It starts off kind of slow, not the very opening of the movie, which is, of course, the big disaster, but when it's sort of getting into the story and sort of introducing the characters, it moves a little bit very slowly, but what it turns out to be just deliberate movements, not necessarily slow movements, and I think it sort of comes together. You know, it's one of these movies like Babel or Crash that's sort of interweaving a couple of different characters that seem completely unrelated and sort of weaves them together towards the end of the movie in a way that makes sense vis-a-vis what the theme of the movie is, in this case, death or hereafter. So I thought it did it really, really well. In fact, I would argue it did it better than those movies like Babel and Crash, because it's about something that's a little bit more relevant, I think, anyway. A little bit more interesting, death, and not just so weird and obscure. I don't even know what the hell Babel was about. And Crash was about race, but I loved it. The day after, I was thinking about it more and more, and like I said before, like that's the most you could ever ask about a movie is to be thinking about it, you know, the next day. I love that when that happens. And Eastwood just makes solid movies. He doesn't ever make movies that suck, you know? Like, I mean, even when he was making stuff like Space Cowboys and Bloodwork, those movies were solid, you know? I mean, they were like a 7 at worst. And this is, you know, this is a really solid movie.
The complaint that I have heard about it is that it's it's not about what it's supposed to be about. I mean, it really doesn't investigate the afterlife phenomenon.
Yeah, I don't think that it was supposed to be about
how
that necessarily.
Could it?
I mean, yeah, how could it? And if it did,
yeah,
I think that would have been a mistake. Like that's what's so great about the movie is how sort of matter of factly it treats people's perception of the hereafter is because we don't know anything, and anyone that says
yeah.
they do, either, you know, the only people who you might be able to listen to are these people who have had, you know, a near-death experience or a death experience, you know, be it on an operating table or during a catastrophe, like, you know, a tsunami. People that have literally, their heart has stopped, they have, you know, lost consciousness and, you know, sort of seen a light. We've all heard those stories. And those stories are always the same. You know, these people, like, they see a light, they see other people going towards it, and time and again, people die, and that's just, we don't have anything to go on for the hereafter other than that. And if we did, he did make a movie that sort of tried to go into the hereafter and examine it, it would turn out hokey. It would turn out like, you know, the Kevin Costner movie Dragonfly or something like that. You know what I mean? It would turn out,
good call. Very good call, Chris.
It would be silly. That's what works so well about the movie. It's Eastwood and Matt Damon, two guys that are just complete straight shooters, and it's very, very straightforward. That's exactly what does work about it.
Okay. Jerry? Jared?
Yeah, no, I agree with Chris. And the more you think about it, Chris brings up a good point, the next day it's even richer in your
yeah.
memory. And, yeah, I agree with you. I mean, the people who are criticizing the movie for that point, like, have they had a near-death experience or something that could, you know, enlighten us? Because I actually think, you know, while watching the movie, I think the middle sort of drags, but the more I think about it, it's
yes.
deliberate,
yes.
almost. And I think the tsunami sequence is quite terrifying.
Yes, very, very scary. And the special effects aren't even very effective, but the special effects are actually a little bit hokey.
Yeah.
But it's it doesn't matter. You know, I mean, the special effects were hokey in movies all the way up until like the 80s. You know,
yeah.
like, but there were good movies nevertheless. If,
right.
a movie, it doesn't have to be perfect. If you're in the hands of a good filmmaker, it really doesn't matter if the effects are hokey. You know, I mean, Sinbad or you know any one of those sort of Harryhausen movies. Like,
yeah.
Those aren't convincing, but they're good movies. And this is
you're
the same
right.
way.
Absolutely, but. I thought all the storylines were very convincing. I thought the one between the brothers was very convincing. But I really,
yeah.
there's something about Matt Damon's story, and especially the cooking class sequences,
yes.
that I thought were very moving. Really got into what was going on in those scenes.
Yeah, and what you say about characters being believable, you know, if there has ever been a psychic character in a movie that I found believable, it was a long time ago because I was trying to think after I saw the movie, has there ever been a psychic in a movie that I really believed was a psychic, you know, as they were telling the story?
Mm.
And there weren't too many that jumped to mind, but I really believed that Matt Damon was a psychic. Like, I took it seriously that this character
mm-hmm.
had a connection with the afterlife and was able to sort of, you know, commune in a very sort of, like, tangential kind of way with
mm-hmm.
the afterlife. It was 100% believable. And I don't believe in that shit. Like, I don't believe in that at all. Not even a tiny bit. The other thing about Matt Damon, he and Eastwood are, I wouldn't be surprised if they continue to make movies together because they've got kind of a Scorsese and De Niro thing going, which is, you know, I mean, great, like, director-actor partnerships often
mm-hmm.
work when they sort of mirror each other. Like, De Niro and Scorsese are both very showy and very over-the-top and dramatic, and that works very well together,
mm-hmm.
or worked very well together. And Eastwood and Damon actually have a lot in common, which is neither one of them ever does more than just the minimum necessary to be effective. They
mm-hmm.
don't ever go over-the-top. They're kind of like, it's kind of like warm bread or something. Like, I mean, there's
right.
nothing fantastic about it. It doesn't have amazing flavors or something, but there's a texture and a warmth to it that is very, very good. And that's the same way that Damon's performance is, the same way that Eastwood movies work, when they do work in the exact same way. Minimal exertion with maximum effectiveness.
I agree. That's actually a very good point to bring up. I guess because some of the pre-release reviews were very mixed, and I wasn't really excited to see this movie, but I'm glad I did because the more I think about it, the more I really like it. I can't say it is really well done. And that's the same thing with Invictus. I wasn't looking forward to Invictus, but when I watched it, I got really wrapped up in the whole story. I was really blown away by it, actually.
Yeah, and you don't know what's going to happen, which is another one of the few great things
it's a beautiful
you can say about a movie.
Point.
There's also, I mean, he's dealing with an international kind of setting, too, which is something that he doesn't do very often. I mean, he did it in Invictus, and there was a sense of place there. But, I mean, do you get a good sense of place? Because it's also, it's something takes place in Europe, the subplot.
It takes place in San Francisco, Paris, and London, largely. And those, it's very distinct, and they jump back and forth lots between those places, and you really do, not just by the characters being there, because sometimes characters are in other places that they're not supposed to be. You know where you're at, and you know who you're with, and you know sort of the culture that you're with. I mean, this really kind of gets into a little bit about the French culture and a little bit about, you know, the English culture, and lots of little sort of supporting characters in the movie, and it's different from anything Eastwood has done. And that's what I like about what Eastwood's doing in the last 5 years or so, is even when these movies like Changeling or Gran Torino or this or Invictus don't work, you know, they're not like they're not taking home Oscars necessarily, and they don't, they're also not tens. I mean, I wouldn't claim that any of those movies are tens. You know, they're eights and nines and sometimes sevens, but they feel genuine for what they are. That's why I don't understand someone complaining because it doesn't investigate the hereafter as it should. Like, I don't like to complain about a movie for what it isn't, you know, because it could have been so many other things. There's plenty of things that go wrong with movies for what they are.
Right.
You don't need to get into what they aren't.
Yeah. I just think they assumed, since the movie was titled Hereafter.
Well, I mean, I think sometimes I think that they assume that Clint Eastwood or whoever the director has, like, this PhD almost in the subject matter. And come on, no one knows. No one knows. So it's just, and he's not claiming to know what exists.
And
he's just giving a thesis almost.
Well,
and
if you have to come out on a certain side. I mean, if you're going to depict it, there's no room for ambiguity, really.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. I was just about to say the exact same thing, which is, What's the end game? Like, what are you going to give an answer? Are you going to be like, I, Clint Eastwood, am now telling you what happens in the afterlife? You know, like, I mean, no, you can't. Like, I reject the idea that they do not investigate the hereafter in the first place. I think that notion is false. I think they do investigate it as well as it can be investigated in a narrative movie like this, you know.
I think with the French woman, they do investigate it. I actually found those sequences when she is in that in-between to be quite chilling, to be honest with you.
Yeah, and not too much, not too little. I mean, it really just looks and sounds and sort of feels like what so many people have described when they have, when, you know, their heart has stopped, when they have, you know, been declared dead for, you know, I mean, everyone's heard these stories. I was declared dead for 6 minutes, you know, on an operating table or something like this, and the stories are always the same. I don't know what else people sort of wanted. I guess people were sort of stomping their feet because they thought Clint Eastwood was going to tell them what happens when they die. You know, like, I don't know. unrealistic expectations. I think so.
I think definitely so.
Okay. We have tonight, we're going to play three brief film score clips. So I want to play our first one now. Just a brief little interlude here. A little later on, you'll hear Hans Zimmer's new score to Megamind, which is the new animated film for the holiday season. That should be big. And at the end of the show, you'll hear John Powell's score to Fair Game, which is a Doug Liman movie with Sean Penn and Naomi Watts. But right now, we're going to play a composer I really, really admire. His name is Mark Killian. I like his stuff a lot. This is for a film called Legacy, and we'll be back on the other side of 2 minutes to talk about Paranormal Activity 2. Oh. Okay, that's Mark Killian. The score is Legacy, and that is available now. Little crazy music, just a little tinge of creepy, which Paranormal Activity is a big tinge of creepy. So I saw this last night in a packed house, which is exactly how I wanted to see it, Paranormal Activity 2.
Mm-hmm.
And Chris, you saw the original, right?
I did.
And
that was not
you
a
haven't,
question.
you haven't seen the you haven't seen the sequel yet, right?
No, and you can drop the yet.
Okay. you're not going to. You have no plans to, apparently.
No, zero.
All right. Well,
so
I,
like drop the spoilers because it does not matter to me.
Okay, we're gonna try not to offer any spoilers, but just be forewarned in case some details come out for anyone out there listening, and jump forward to 15 minutes from now if you want to miss it. See, I like the first Paranormal Activity. I thought it was effective, and I thought that this was equally effective. I think it's pretty much the exact same experience as Paranormal Activity, but I like the way they did it. I thought it was an ingenious way to do a sequel to it. I like that they kept it cheap, bare bones, which is what made the first one effective. I liked the characters in it.
Mm-hmm.
I like the device of it being a not a sequel as much as a prequel. And a movie that, for the most part, is going on the same time as the original film
mm-hmm.
is taking place.
Right.
In a different location. And I like how it tied in the characters from the first movie to the second movie. And there's always also the element of they bring in a baby, which always raises the stakes in this kind of movie. I honest to God, maybe if I wasn't watching it with a full house that was reacting as they were, I wouldn't find it nearly as effective. I'd
mm-hmm.
have to watch it at home or something to discover if the movie really goes the distance on its own as a movie. But man, I mean, it was a roller coaster ride with that audience, and genuinely frightening in a couple of places for me. I mean, chills up my thighs, kind of frightening.
I agree with that. I actually think this is better than the original. I don't know as a movie, though, whether it will, in the terms of how long it will last, but I think adding a child and a dog into the mix is very effective. And I think, once again, when we talked about with the Strangers sound work, the sound on this is the most important thing on a film, because those thumps and everything you hear really add a chilling element to the movie. And I can understand why people wouldn't like these movies, but I think seeing them in the theater is effective. I liked it. I'm not a big horror movie buff, but for some reason, these movies like The Last Exorcism and the Paranormal Activity movies, I like.
Well, the reason why I look, this could have gone the way of Blair Witch 2. They could have tried something completely different. And it would have fallen on its face.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, they're smart. You knew that a sequel was inevitable because it's the highest grossing film in relation to cost of all time. So you knew they were going to make a sequel to it.
Right.
So,
oh, yeah, absolutely.
Bearing that in mind, I'm glad they went this way with the
mm-hmm.
sequel. For me, it was the same experience, essentially. So
right.
If they're going to make a sequel to that movie, they did it as they should have done it. Now, what strikes me about the concept of Paranormal Activity and what I really like about it is its simplicity and its kind of old-fashioned manner. Because the audience is absolutely active on what they're seeing on screen. Those static security camera shots or video
mm-hmm.
camera shots, the audience is scanning the entire frame trying to see what might occur in that frame. And so I think it's very special. I mean, the audience does the work, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right.
And it relies on very kind of old-fashioned devices.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't rely on effects. You can feel fear from a creaking door.
Right.
You know, or little voices or footsteps or a slamming door. That kind of stuff still works. And it always amazes me, and it delights me watching these two movies.
Mm-hmm.
So, Chris, what was your problem with the original, and why won't you see the sequel?
I didn't necessarily have a problem with it. I did not see it in the theater, and I believe I saw it on DVD, and I believe that it probably is true that it's one of these movies. Had I seen it in the theater on a Friday night with a full crowd of people, there's a very good chance I would have enjoyed it much, much more.
Mm-hmm.
I watched it by myself at home in my underwear with a glass of wine. So, you know.
Wait, that was an option? Shit.
Yeah. Yeah. You want
I watched it
scary.
In the theater in my underwear with a glass of wine. So.
I just didn't, I'm not into the slamming door and the loud, you know, the loud crash and, you know, that kind of stuff as a scare. I mean, I guess I would be for like, you know, a YouTube clip or something like that, or maybe a shorter film. I didn't find that it worked, as far as for me, for scares, you know, in the long form like that, at all. I don't believe in ghosts. And like we were talking about Hereafter, like I don't believe in psychics, but Hereafter made me believe he was a psychic. Well, I don't believe in ghosts, and Paranormal Activity just did not convince me of ghosts. You know, I mean, like it did not sell it to me. But like I said, I am 100% willing to believe that it's one of those movies that had I seen it in a theater, I probably would have gotten drawn up into that communal experience.
You know, I don't believe in spirits and that kind of stuff either. I mean, but at least as a horror movie convention, I mean, that kind of thing has never scared me. I mean, the guy that can chop you up that lives next door scares me because that's something tangible and real. I mean, I'm scared if the actors I see on screen are genuinely scared and I feel their fear and I empathize with them. And I think this movie did that well. And you know, the biggest scare in the first Paranormal Activity for me, as I'm sure for a lot of people, was when whatever it is takes her from the bed and drags her across the floor. And that scare is essentially repeated in twofold. I mean, that's... I saw with my older brother, I turned around to him at that moment, and he was... He was kind of shaken, and this was a movie that everybody was screaming at every single opportunity, and we were kind of laughing at it. But that moment got us, and another moment in the kitchen, where she's alone, got us.
Oh yeah,
you know. So and it really lulls you. And this is directed by someone with a track record. I mean, this is directed by the guy that did Door in the Floor, Jeff Bridges' John Irvin movie. I like the way he did it. It's written by a TV veteran screenwriter. It lulls you into a false sense of security in a way, and then it just unleashes hell. And I like films that escalate like that in the horror genre. All right. So what else is going on? Have you guys seen anything of note or read any headlines? I guess we should bring this up.
There's been a couple. There's been a couple interesting things in the last week or so, yeah.
Well, Mel Gibson is one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Hangover 2. This is what's interesting about this story to me. We talked about it last show, Jerry. If Mel Gibson cameoed in Hangover 2, it seemed to fit the mold based on what they did for Tyson in the first Hangover.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was the thinking behind it. Zach Galifianakis, I thought it was a joke at first. He came out and he was opposed to that notion that Mel Gibson be cast. And then, I guess, because of that, they dropped Mel Gibson from it. And the most surprising element is Todd Phillips, the director, came out and said, yes, he's out, because some of our cast and crew didn't appreciate the notion of Mel Gibson being in the movie. So now Liam Neeson has that role.
It's the first name that came to my mind.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you can't go Mel Gibson, it might as well be Liam Neeson. Somebody whose name rhymes with... Yeah.
If it's not Braveheart, it's Rob Roy.
They're like, yeah, this is the cameo we normally reserve for rapists and wife abusers, but you'll do.
Yeah. I didn't know what to make of the replacement. That's the thing that really just called me, wow, Lee Meeson, okay.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, so maybe that means Mel Gibson's unemployable for the time being.
Well, this is the conversation we were having, you know, just 6 months ago, whenever all this sort of came out, was, oh, will people get over this? Is Mel Gibson's career over? This doesn't necessarily prove one way or the other that his career is over.
Yeah, I agree with Chris.
It certainly proves that for right now, there is still, you know, it's not Tom Cruise jumping on a couch or calling Matt Lauer glib. It's people are a little bit more ticked off about Gibson than they are. I also think it's funny that that Galifianakis now like pulls more weight than Mel Gibson. You know, like Mel Gibson,
yeah,
the star of, you know, so many blockbusters. If you'd gone back to the '80s, you know, in like 1989, like at the height of Mel Gibson's fame, shown him a picture of, you know, fat bearded Zach Galifianakis and said, "Hey, in 20 years, this guy's gonna fire you from this is an actor that's gonna get you kicked off a set." And, you know, Mel Gibson was like, "Get the fuck out of here."
Well, I think Galifianakis is more valuable to the Hangover franchise, and I think that's why he wields power in this.
Well,
decision.
Yeah, obviously.
Oh yeah,
obviously.
I mean, in that regard, yeah.
What surprises me
so.
Is it's not the audience. I mean, because the audience has been polled. I've seen polling. I don't know who does this polling, but that they don't really care. They'd be willing to see another Mel Gibson movie in spite of the controversy surrounding him. What surprises me is the element I didn't expect that I should have, that, you know, a lot of people don't want to work with him. You know, that's why he's probably going to be devoid of opportunities for a long time.
Yes.
Anyway.
Most likely.
Yeah. thank you.
And rightfully so.
Yeah. Yeah. So tell what else you have on your mind, Chris? You said there are some other headlines that we could discuss this week.
Oh, that was the main one that sort of jumped to mind. There's some other stuff. You know, the Hobbit casting finally came about, which is great. And the whole Hobbit sort of runaround with the Hobbit has been crazy. Like. So
yeah.
Weird that they made this like trilogy of movies that was so hugely successful, and you know, normally like you can't shut Hollywood up enough and like sort of calm them down and hold them back to make a sequel. And this movie has just been plagued with problems from the beginning. It's so weird, but it does seem like it's sort of finally getting off the ground now, which is interesting. So Martin Freeman from the British Office is going to play
Bilbo
Baggins, it looks like, and that's. Brilliant, inspired casting, I think.
Maybe it's a good thing that it's been plagued with development problems, like the first trilogy. I mean, it worked out well enough for the first set of films, so maybe that's a good omen.
Right.
That it's been a challenge to get something they care about off the ground. So
yeah.
Maybe it'll be more than worth it, worth that effort.
Yeah, I hope so.
Yeah. What about you, Jerry? Have you seen anything other than the two movies that we've discussed?
I saw a very scary movie. Maybe not the way we're traditionally linked to horror, but I saw the documentary Inside Job.
Mm.
Yeah.
And that makes Paranormal Activity just look like child's play. That's a film that will get you angry. So angry. It's very well done. If you liked Ferguson's No End in Sight, then I think you'll about the Iraq War, then you'll definitely like this. But this is really in-depth, in detail, about the financial meltdown of 2008 and the repercussions that we're still living with. And it's worthwhile checking out. If it comes to your neighborhood, if it doesn't, it will definitely be available on DVD. But it's it will make you angry. It will depress you. It will make you angry. It will scare you. This is the thing that really stands out for me from the movie. One of the gentlemen that was interviewed, not Elliot Spitzer, and his time on screen is valuable, regardless of what you think of that show he does with Kathleen Parker on CNN or his sexual exploits. They say something very interesting. We've made such a big deal about the billionaires in this last decade. And one of the guys interviewed said, the one thing they don't tell you about the billionaires is it's not their money that they're playing with. They don't. It's not their money. They don't have that money. That's your money from the banks, from your local bank or whatever. And I think that line alone will send you into a frenzy.
So they don't have the money. How are they living?
Yeah, that's them. I don't. It's like they're taking all these.
If you don't have it, they gotta have it.
Yeah, if you don't have it, they have it. But they basically the money that we lost, the money that was lost was your money. When they take that risk, that's talked about, it's not their. They don't take a risk.
Well, they didn't earn the money; they stole it. Yeah,
they stole it. And one of the guys brings up a great point about he's talking about someone, and he says, "Oh, he thought he was so smart." Well, no, he wasn't smart. He was just taking your money. You know, and using it.
He was an opportunist.
Yeah. It's worth, I actually think it's one of those films like No End in Sight or Capitalism, A Love Story, that everyone should check out if they can. It's definitely worthwhile.
Yeah, I definitely want to see it. Hmm. I did see the Elliot Spitzer documentary. I don't know if I.
No, you didn't tell us. How's that?
It's fine. I mean, it's about so much more than the sex scandal. He's an intelligent guy.
That's the tragedy. He's so bright, and the sad thing is, this is a guy who could have been president of the United States one day.
Yeah, he was on his way.
Yeah,
and you know, it's not the first time that someone's sexual urges have taken their lives in another direction. I guess the big question is, should it have? Should that play a role? You know, but it does play as a kind of tragic into whatever meaningful political career he would have had.
Mm-hmm.
Chris, do you have a thought on Elliot Spitzer? I think it's a perfect last name, actually.
I've been waiting for that for years on this show.
Yeah, if only his last name was Swallowter.
That's an instrument, isn't it? That's what they used to. That was the sister of the kazoo, I think, back then.
Swallowter?
Yes. Anyway.
No thoughts whatsoever.
Okay. Did you see The Human Centipede yet, Chris?
No, I didn't. No.
You don't have any interest?
No, I absolutely do. I just haven't got a chance to rent it. Certainly haven't been able to talk my wife into watching it with me.
Well, come on over. I'll let you see it.
Oh, you'll let me see your human centipede? I didn't realize.
I don't think we really needed that on the whole show to everyone to hear, but okay, thanks.
On the phone with Brett Favre all of a sudden.
Yeah. Good old Brett Favre. I liked what Brett Favre had to say about Brett Favre. I liked what Bill Maher had to say about Brett Favre.
Yeah, that was great.
Yeah, he's very funny. True Grit, I did see that trailer again when I saw Paranormal Activity 2 the other night. That's the movie, man.
Yeah, that's a really exciting trailer. The casting is perfect, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really funny book, and I feel like they got the casting so right with that. And the Coen brothers, I don't know, I feel like maybe they're poised to go on another run of great movies. I certainly hope so. How about Spielberg? Spielberg announced his next movie, Robo Apocalypse. Like, it couldn't sound less interesting to me.
So is this Spielberg's Transformers? It's based on a book that hasn't come out yet. I guess they optioned it as it was being written.
Yeah,
I think so.
The story is humans have to fight off, have to fight a war against robots who are taking over. I mean, just. I don't know. I mean, I love Spielberg, and I'll go see it because it's Spielberg. But I mean, it just sort of sounds like AI meets Transformers meets Terminator.
Meets
Matrix. Meets War of the Worlds. Meets Matrix.
Yeah.
I mean, it just sounds so...
derivative.
There's so many... I would so rather see him make the Abraham Lincoln movie or, so many other projects I would like to see him make. And I really feel like in this part of his career, he's getting better results with the sort of serious kind of adult stuff that he does. When he's making Indiana Joneses and War of the Worlds, and they're not really, they don't seem to be affecting me anyway as much as the Private Ryans and the Munichs and things like that.
Yeah, I agree with Chris, although I do like War of the Worlds more than most people, but I agree, I understand where Chris is coming from. I would, when I read this, I had read, I think, the night before that they were remaking Colossus, the Forbin Project, and I was just like, why would you even remake that now? Because the Terminator, the Matrix movies, and or AI have really, are sort of the same thing. And I don't understand why he's even going. Is this reminding me? The first thing I thought of was the iRobot movie from a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And why would he do this? This seems, but this does seem beneath Spielberg more than anything else.
Yeah, it feels like that's the sort of thing like that he thinks. It seems like he thinks maybe he should have made Transformers to begin with, or something like that. Because I don't know. Maybe it's also the title. I hate that title.
Robot-pocalypse. Oh, it's a horrible title.
Like, I really hate that. I mean, it sounds like, I remember in Big when they pick up, like, it's one of the toys from Big is Truckosaur.
Yeah.
It sounds like it was cooked up in a board meeting somewhere. And kids love trucks and kids love dinosaurs. Let's make Truckosaur.
Yeah,
and, you
yeah,
know, like,
you're right.
Apocalyptic movies are popular and robot movies are popular. Robopocalypse. Like, you know, like, it sounds so corny. Like, from the guy that just, you know, fairly recently made Munich, you know, one of the more interesting movies made in the last 10 years. And, you know, I don't, it's a little bit to me, like, you know, like, I just couldn't, I can't bring myself to give a shit, I guess.
I agree. I think Chris brings up a great point here. I mean, when you see, you know, I get email alerts from The Wrap or Nikki Fink, and when I saw this, I was just like, you've got to be kidding me. Is this like an April Fool's joke, like way ahead of the time or way? I mean,
yeah.
It just seems like Robopocalypse, this is what you're holding out on? I agree with Chris. I would much rather see the Lincoln movie.
Yeah, me too. That's a long time coming.
Yeah, we're not going to get that anytime soon.
Is Top Gun 2 a long time coming?
Do we need that?
God.
Apparently it's happening. With
yeah,
Tony
I know
Scott.
It's happening, but...
But Tom Cruise has said no, right?
Yeah, I'm sure, yes. But I mean, Tony Scott said yes. And,
yeah,
you know, I'm sure they're going to bring in a new young cast for it.
But call it something else. Like those sorts of movies where they do the sequel, except you don't get the star of the original, those sort of sequels, they never work, do they?
I'm sure they'll get Skerritt. Val Kilmer's not busy.
He can't. That
you mean
the
MacGruber
sequel's
not happening?
A plane. Well, they would have to drop a few hundred pounds from the luggage department to get that plane to take off. Kilmer's not getting in a fighter jet anytime soon. And I love Kilmer, but he's definitely not going to be Iceman. No, that's not going to be happening. I don't know. I just don't see that a sequel. You know, I mean, Lost Boys, they sort of talked about making a Lost Boys sequel for a long time. And, you know, it seemed like maybe it's a good idea, maybe it isn't. They didn't get anybody that sort of mattered from the original. They made a sequel, went straight to DVD. I can sort of see that sort of thing happening with Top Gun.
Yeah,
Top Gun
and they've done a third that's gone straight to DVD, too, for Lost Boys. I don't know. Top Gun, it's not a movie I hold in high regard or have any kind of passion for.
I hear you, dude. I'm with you on that 100%.
But can it be made for this time? I mean, can it matter at all, or would people be interested in it for this time? I mean, it strikes me as something that would probably be along the lines of stealth, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like that's maybe what it would be. I mean, the movie's not really about much. I mean, it's just sort of a kind of a, you know, vaguely homoerotic action comedy.
Maybe they
like,
should.
Sort of a nameless enemy. I mean, there really was no enemy whatsoever. I mean, I guess, like, sort of the Russians, but they never sort of came out and said that in the movie.
Right.
They would definitely come out and say, you know, name an enemy. Although, I don't know who it would be. We don't get into a lot of dogfights with, you know, fucking Afghanis or whatever.
No, that's right. So, maybe, yeah, you know, you're absolutely right. Chris brings up a really good point. We don't have the dog fights anymore with anyone, really. Even in the Iraq war, we didn't.
Yeah. But it would just give us another opportunity for a volleyball scene with Kenny Loggins playing with the boys in the background.
Well, I mean, if you want to go there, I mean, I hope. Are you going to fund it? Are you going to put up the money for that scene?
Has there? But that's what I remember about Top Gun. I mean, I remember the phenomenon of the soundtrack too. When Kenny Loggins was king of movie soundtracks. Has there been anything recently that the soundtrack is? I mean, am I missing something since Titanic, where the soundtrack has really overshadowed the movie in a way, or become made the movie more popular?
Definitely.
Oh brother,
overshadowed it. You know, that one was the soundtrack was more popular than the movie. The movie really wasn't that popular when it came out. Like, but as far as pop music, no, I don't think so. Titanic's a good one. I know the Romeo and Juliet soundtrack was very, very successful, probably more so than the movie. No, I don't think so. Not any that leap to mind. That volleyball scene, man, that is the gayest thing ever committed to film. I mean, you could literally film two dudes having butt sex for 27 minutes, and it would not be as gay as the volleyball scene from Top Gun.
Wait, is this the wrong movie to remake? Shouldn't it be Sleep With Me with the Quentin Tarantino explanation at the end?
Yes, very true.
All right, well, I don't think any of us are holding our breath for Top Gun 2, but it's going to happen.
No. Mm-hmm. Which is a good thing, because it would take our breath away.
Also, Bodyguard. I mean, Bodyguard is one of those that the soundtrack was the movie was a mega hit, but the soundtrack even more so.
Hey, by the way, I know you guys talked about it already. You must have, but Aronofsky directing a Wolverine movie.
Mm, yeah.
What do you think about that, Chris?
You know, it's interesting. Jamie and I were sort of talking online recently about Kubrick. You know, I think that Movie Geeks United is sort of maybe working up, you know, something, you know, paying tribute to Kubrick.
Mm-hmm.
We were just sort of having a casual conversation online about, like, who is the modern successor to the throne of Kubrick. And we were sort of throwing around names. There's nobody that absolutely falls into that category. But I think that we sort of came up with David Fincher when we were talking, and that makes sense in some ways. But I think that Aronofsky makes sense in a lot of ways, too.
Mm-hmm.
Technically proficient filmmaker who sort of takes on these very large themes certainly in the case of Requiem for a Dream, and even, you know, in the case of The Wrestler and Black Swan, which he has said are both about entertainment, you know, high entertainment and the lowest form of entertainment. They're sort of bookends, in his opinion. I wonder what people thought, like, the really, like, intellectual fans of Kubrick in, you know, when he decided that he was going to make The Shining, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I bet that people sort of had the same reaction to that, because at the time, Stephen King was not Stephen King. I mean, he had written Carrie, and he was a successful horror writer, but he was, you know, he was not considered to be the great novelist and the proficient novelist that he is today.
Right, you're absolutely right, Chris, yeah.
Yeah, I would think that people had sort of the same reaction in film circles when they found out Kubrick's making that Stephen King guy's new horror movie. What? Mm. But I wouldn't be surprised, and I'm not saying that Aronofsky is Kubrick. There's a lot of differences.
No, I understand. I understand what you mean. Perfectly.
But he's sort of a cerebral filmmaker and sort of an auteur in the same way that Kubrick was. And I wouldn't be surprised if he was truly interested in making it truly had an idea for something. Now, the only thing I don't know is there a set script for this movie, or is he going to be working on that?
Yeah, it goes back to what we were talking about, I guess, 2 years ago about, or a year and a half ago about the Wolverine. You know, I think these things are so, I don't think the directors, because with Marvel, it seems that they're all prepping for this Avengers movie.
Yeah.
I don't know if anyone, I don't know what, with a second Wolverine, if there's as much free reign as we think, because of this X-Men First Class movie that Matthew Vaughn is directing. I don't know if Aronofsky is going to have the freedom that he is used to, or the creativity he's used to with this.
Yeah.
I don't know, and don't get me wrong in saying, when I say I believe that Aronofsky has a vision for this movie, don't get me wrong and think that I'm saying there's no way this movie could be bad, because I'm certainly the first to say that I did not like the first Wolverine movie, and I often do not like comic book movies, although I liked comic book movies when I was a child, or comic books when I was a child.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't be surprised, regardless, if what you're saying is true, you know, that Aronofsky does not have as much control. The studio controls this thing.
Mm-hmm.
He's a director for hire. And I also wouldn't be surprised if this was a situation where, you know, sort of like Mark Romanek with The Wolfman, which is,
mm-hmm.
you know, it doesn't ultimately come to fruition. That would not surprise me at all, because he seems too sort of idiosyncratic as a filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
I have a hard time imagining what an Aronofsky Wolverine movie would be like, especially for someone who has seen the original Wolverine movie.
Yeah.
I mean, I know I've mentioned it before, but it bears repeating. That movie is, I mean, really,
it's awful.
Really, it's a laugh out loud, ridiculously bad. I mean,
they really
quite terrible.
It makes the third X-Men movie somewhat bearable, I think. I mean,
yeah, because the third X-Men movie was not very good, but it wasn't embarrassing.
Yeah, the Wolverine movie, I mean, we've talked about this when it came out. I mean, it starts off with some promise, but it quickly goes downhill. I don't know what a sequel. I thought a sequel was abandoned. I thought everyone was focusing their energy on X-Men First Class. So when I saw this thing about Aronofsky directing the second Wolverine, I was like, oh, my God, they're going forward with this.
And he obviously wants to make a movie like this.
Mm-hmm.
He was flirting with RoboCop. He was flirting with Superman. He was flirting with Batman.
Mm-hmm.
He obviously really wants to make a movie like this, so he obviously really has an idea how to do it. Because all those stories are sort of dark, you know, RoboCop and Batman and
right.
Wolverine are sort of dark, and from what everyone's saying, the studio wants a darker sort of Superman. So he has an idea. He's obviously very, very interested. So let's see now how that plays out, because, man, I have a hard time imagining it.
I don't think he'd jump on board unless he did have creative control over it. And I think a lot of it has to do, like we discussed last show, with his friendship with Hugh Jackman.
Mm-hmm.
Hugh Jackman he's probably doing him a solid in some way, or
mm-hmm.
vice versa, since they have a relationship.
Yeah.
Don't they?
It's possible.
Yeah, they
I mean, they made a hugely unsuccessful movie together.
It's interesting. No, and in Chris Springs' book, they did make a hugely unsuccessful movie, a movie that I like, but a movie that all three of us know was supposed to be something more than it was, and then Brad Pitt and Kate Blanchett backed out of it. So that's like one of those, I think, great what-ifs. What if that had worked as originally planned?
My successor to James Cameron, I can't talk tonight. I just learned how to speak English. My successor to Stanley Kubrick, like we were discussing, Chris, is James Cameron.
Yeah.
I mean, there's not going to be anyone exactly like Kubrick, but
mm-hmm. No.
Yeah.
There's never going to be any two directors that are exactly alike, you know, but those two make sense. I mean, Cameron
mm-hmm.
is interested in, you know, technology in the same sort of way that Kubrick was. He makes these very large, ambitious projects in the same way that Kubrick does or did. So, yeah, I mean, that makes sense, too. But he doesn't necessarily always have the sort of cerebral qualities that Kubrick did. But like you said, no one's going to be exactly Kubrick.
Yeah. All right, guys. We're going to play our last interview. I enjoyed it. We're going to be here every day next week. with our horror movie series, and then next Sunday we'll be back with Gail Ann Hurd, mega producer of The Walking Dead, the new TV series, and The Terminator and Aliens, speaking of James Cameron. And she'll be giving us an update on a new De Palma project as well that she's producing for him. And then we got some great guests coming up in the month of November, including J.W. Rinsler, the author of The Making of The Empire Strikes Back. So we'll continue our 30th anniversary coverage of that. We'll have Anthony Mackie and Kerry Washington and a whole group of great guests coming up next month. So stay tuned for that. Chris, buddy, are you looking forward to anything in the movie horizon for the next week?
for the next week. Jeez, I don't even know what comes out next week.
Saw 3D.
No. Certainly not. No, I will not be going to see Saw.
No, I hear you there, brother.
I like the Saw movies, but I watch them on DVD or cable.
Smart man.
Yeah.
Well, Chris, the offer still stands. The Human Centipede is right here on my entertainment center.
Yeah, why do you have it on your...
Wow.
Yeah, take it off your entertainment center and put it back in your pants where it belongs.
You know, there is one movie, though. It comes out near us, and it'll probably come out near you guys soon. The girl kicked the hornet's nest, the third girl.
That's where you're wrong. Things like that do not come out near us.
Oh, they don't? Wait. Oh, I didn't know that. I didn't mean to insult. I did not mean that in a negative way.
No. We don't get movies like that until, you know, two or three months after their initial release date.
Mm.
If we do want, we can see them, but we would have to travel, what, Jamie, like 2 hours or something like that?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry. I didn't mean it to sound like that.
By the way, Chris, do you work Wednesday night?
Wednesday night. Let's see. Wednesday night. No, I do not.
Well, if you want to go to a screening with me, you're more than welcome to.
Oh, yeah? What do you want to see?
Love and Other Drugs.
Love and Other Drugs. Oh, really? Damn.
Yeah.
Go see it, man. Go see it.
It's at Veterans. Yeah. It'll be an opportunity for us to go see a movie together.
That'd
we can hold
amazing.
Hands
we
like we used to.
I know. Walk out crying like we used to.
We can watch it in our underwear, drinking wine.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Way ahead of you. Way ahead of you.
Anyway, I'll get in touch with you, and we'll figure out if we're able to do that together, man.
All right, cool.
All right, buddy. Thank you for calling in.
Yeah, thank you, Chris.
Yeah, it was fun. All right, see you.
All right, buddy. Bye-bye. All right, before we get to our last interview of the night, James Housler, one more score, and then we'll finish the show with a third piece of score. This one here right now, though, Hans Zimmer's score to Megamind, which is available for purchase. Thank you. Jay, that's Hans Zimmer Megamind, which is available for purchase from Amazon or wherever you purchase your CD soundtracks. That's the new one from a great composer. I'm sure it'll be a really successful animated holiday film.
Yeah, I saw
the trailer for that. Yeah, you know that's going to be a big one. Okay, we spoke to Robert Forrester at the beginning of the show. If you missed any part of that, you can hear it on replay right after the live show airs tonight. Now we're going to talk to the writer-director of the new film he co-stars in. His name is Mr. James Housler, and the film is called Calamity. It is currently in limited release. Here is James telling us all about it. When you sat down to write this, what about it you felt connected to? Was there a theme that you're connecting with that you wanted to bring to life in this piece?
Well, you know, it's funny you say that, because I often think that way. And for me, I think a lot of the time things are musically driven, like these sort of fictional stories are often born around or from a song, and often elements of my own life, I think, like many other writers, get mixed into what I'm doing. So I had just gotten out of a long relationship myself, and my best friend just got out of a long relationship himself. He's not psychotic, but I think those things plus the first, I think a song that had the greatest inspiration with the film was probably Angel Baby by Ozzy and the Originals. And I sometimes just get these oldies stuck in my head, and they just loop and loop and loop. And I think thematically it really fit the story I was trying to tell very well, too. So, I mean, I don't know. I hope that answers some kind of question. I can just keep going and going.
Absolutely.
So.
Music is so incredibly powerful, and it's the fastest way to someone's heart, I find, music.
Yeah,
It
absolutely.
Just speaks so profoundly. So that was that song in your situation, in your friend's situation, was the initial inspiration. As you're writing, do you write by music?
Do I write? I'm sorry, I got a little bit of an iPhone 4 here.
Okay, when you're writing, do you constantly play music for inspiration as you're writing?
It depends. If it's a scene that I've given a lot of thought to, and I mean often when I make something, I already know before even shooting what songs I want to use in it, and what songs, you know, what music inspirations I have. So if it's a scene that's based around the song, or that if I'm imagining in my head cutting back and forth to a song or to a beat or, you know, something like that, then yes, I will. I'll loop it. I mean, I'll listen to it 45 times in a row until you know, I at least draft out a scene.
Mm-hmm. I'm also curious your process for writing. Do you know exactly where you're going? Do you outline before you start typing it up, or is it a process? Does it just evolve? It surprises you as it comes out.
It surprises. Well, see. This is with Calamity. This is more of an interesting story than usual, because I wrote it. I knew what I wanted to do at the beginning. I knew what I had to do, and then for some reason I didn't feel like doing that. So I wrote it twice and started over again, which I've never done before. I've never completely scrapped something before, but finally, I decided that I was going to do what I had set out to do to begin with. But as far as the process, I think once I get a feel for the characters, often they make their own decisions in the story. Mm-hmm. And I know that sounds weird, but I'll have things planned out to some degree. But sometimes when I'm writing, you just kind of, you know, it's in a character's nature to do or say something, and I'll just kind of, you know, not wing it, but it's just, I mean, when you're in the zone, it just kind of happens.
Yeah. And how about other films? I mean, if you're working on a film like Calamity, and it's your goal to make a believable thriller that anyone can relate to, which I think Calamity is, do you look to other kinds of films for inspiration as well?
Well, here's the thing about that. I have a strict no film watching rule when I'm writing. I will not watch if it comes to, and I love movies. I have a couple thousand DVDs I've been collecting since I was like 13. So I will not, if I'm working on a screenplay like I have been these past couple months, I will not watch a movie for 2 months if I have to. I mean, I just like the slate to be wiped completely clean, no current inspirations, no nothing. You know, anything that's already there is sort of deeply embedded in as far as inspiration goes. But I don't like watch movies to sort of bring myself to where I need to be. I just kind of try to keep it honest and from the heart, I guess.
Well, I think that's a great policy because it means that your films are not derivative of any other films out there. And so many are carbon copies of everything you've already seen, you know, so yours really stand out because of that.
Well, thank you. You know, as far as this film goes, I mean, for me, honesty was the most important factor in writing. And not to say that a lot of thrillers and psychological dramas or however, I don't even understand genre categories anyway, but as far as all this different stuff goes, I mean, a lot of them touch on, you know, different things that Calamity is, but I wanted to make sure that I was being as honest with the audience and with myself as a writer the whole time as I could.
Yeah. Well, in terms of what you've observed and felt yourself, in terms of the effects of a breakup on the man. I mean, I've been through it too. It can be pretty severe. But as you observed, what is that different reaction that men have from women during a breakup, you know?
Well, okay. There's another thing I want to say. I'll answer that, and I want to use that as kind of a springboard. But But I mean, I don't know. It's weird. I mean, I always with myself with women, I always try to be as honest and open and, you know, and accepting of things as I can. I'm not really the type to get explosive or blow up about things. I just kind of, I mean, something bad happens in my life, I'm just like, well, that's how it is. You know, it's reality. So, I can only really speak about myself with that, but. As far as what I observed when, and this applies to Calamity, I observed that every time something would come up in my life after I got out, because I was in a long relationship. So, you know, when you're in a long relationship, every time something happens in your life, who do you call? You call your girlfriend or you tell her about it or something like that. So that applies to Calamity because it's not that I would imagine having conversations, with my ex-girlfriend, but every time something would happen, I would find that I would feel like I wanted to say something to her, or I would think of her like, because that's who you go to. So, in Calamity, when Billy is experiencing all this stuff that's going on, and along with the breakup and stuff like that, he, you know, there's sort of this physical, you know, manifestation of Alice in his mind, like, you know, he would be taught, like he's imagining what he would be saying to her in that situation if she was there. And you know, so that's kind of what that means to me. And that was probably my biggest observation getting out of a long relationship and how it applies to the movie.
Yeah. And in your film, I mean, he no longer really has her to go to and talk to and confide in anymore. So he reaches out to his oldest best friend, and he's not quite there either. Obviously.
to say the least. I have kind of a fascination with stories and that are at their climax. Like, if you were to look at it from a grander scale, Calamity would be maybe the climax of a bigger story. Like, you know, if it were maybe a book or something, it would be the last few chapters. Mm-hmm. And I kind of like to, you know, when I write things, I like them to be windows into that. I hope that makes sense. I mean,
yeah,
who knows
if
anything I say makes sense, but you know, it's kind of like all this stuff has already happened with Stanley and all this stuff like that, and Billy's just sort of arrives at the boiling point.
I have a couple questions about the production of the film. First of all, when you're writing, you know that you're probably writing an independent film. You're writing for an independent budget. Do you feel limited by that at all in the decisions you make in the writing phase?
You know, not really. I mean, I've written a couple screenplays where I've been like, well, how the hell would I ever pull this off? I mean, like, you know, this is far too bizarre for anybody to want to back or anything like that. But so sometimes I've found that's been, I don't really think like that. And when it comes down to it, production wise, you have to make some hard decisions and lose a couple of things you care about here and there. But as long as the story doesn't suffer, then I think it's just part of the game.
But you've assembled just a stellar cast in this film too, man. I mean, it's a beautiful cast. Tell me how exciting it is to hear your words and see the world that you created come to life with the actors when they get a hold of it for the first time.
That geeks out any director, any writer-director, I think, or any writer. I mean, you just when it's right, you know, it's just like a mental erection. I know that's not appropriate to say it like that, but you know, when you get it right, or when they get it right, you just like, you know, it's unbelievable to you to see it. These guys, Nick, Jonathan, you know, Bo, and Alona, and Robert, you know, and even Chris, you know, it's just they all hit it so closely. I can't imagine it having come out another way. I mean, I was just very happy with them.
Does it become something more at that point once other people come into it and bring life to it? Because
you've been
living with it all alone for 2 months writing it.
Yeah, well, it absolutely does. And I'm a huge, huge, I mean, like, collaborator when it comes to everything. I love what people bring to the table. You know, like, say, you know, actors will walk up and they'll say, hey, you know, I don't think this doesn't feel Stanley to me, or, you know, how about I try it like this, or and anything. I mean, any ideas they have, I'm always so excited to hear it because that's what the actor doesn't only say the lines on screen. They bring, you know, their personality. They bring their sort of expanded personality that is the character, and they bring a whole wealth of ideas that excite them, and you want them to be excited about it, and you want them to feel creatively free. So,
and you're dealing with two lead characters that are best friends, and that obviously have a history together. Is it important that they establish a rapport as actors prior to shooting? Did you have any kind of rehearsal or get together time before you started shooting?
You know, we had a little bit, but the tough part about truly independent productions, you know, like truly, truly independent productions, is that, I mean, it's time. You know, the actors are there for it. Plus, we're in Virginia too; they're not in L.A. They can't just pop over. So you have a limited amount of time to get there. you know, if it's a tough scene, you might rehearse it, or you might try to review a couple times. But really, they didn't have that much time. But Nick and Jonathan are just such unbelievably great people. I mean, like, great human beings. They're open-minded and, you know, very, very nice guys. So, I mean, I think they both sensed that immediately. And they also had the been actors since they were children thing in common. So mm-hmm. they just kind of, they hit it off. And they were kind of, and, you know, they surprised each other. So.
And I think that Jonathan's performance in particular is going to surprise a lot of people in this. And it seems like a real kind of tight wire performance, a real balance that he's achieved here, because he's slowly losing it. I mean, he's kind of going crazy. But at the same time, I would think it would be so easy to go over the top with that. But he keeps it real and relatable all the way, I think.
Oh, yeah. And that's one of the things I was trying to accomplish with the script too, was trying to, I was like, oh my God, how many times in movies have people gone sorry, I almost cussed, but
that's fine, you can curse. This is okay. The internet, you can do whatever you want.
Okay, all right. But how many times in movies have people just gone absolutely like batshit crazy, and had it be kind of over the top? I didn't see. I felt like with Jonathan, it was so incredibly internal. It almost would, while we were shooting, give me anxiety to see that, and then talk to him afterward. I'd be like,
And you know, I think it's probably, I would think, implicit in your writing of the script too, because I think what really makes that come across is the fact that you know that he's horrified by how far he's able to go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well that's I think kind of I mean, when you talk about themes, it's always hard for me to boil it down to one thing and summarize, but I mean, thematically speaking, as far as him going crazy goes, I think that that's one thing I thought was really important to the story, is that Stanley was just as conflicted as everybody else about Stanley mm-hmm. going down that road. I mean, I think it would be a different movie if that wasn't the case.
So when you've shown this film to audiences, I'm sure, you've played festivals and things with it?
Yeah, actually, we kind of darted past the festival, and just trying to get it out, I guess you could say.
Okay.
Not as much, but you know, it's been screened for people, and people have seen it. And
how nerve-wracking is that when you're kind of letting go of your baby and you're showing it to an audience for the first time?
You know, you just have to. That's the toughest part for me, because I mean, number one, I hate introducing stuff because I'm just so terrified, and I can't really watch it with the audience, because if someone so much as farted, I would, you know, have an aneurysm. But but you know, it's scary, but it's part of what you have to do, and you hope for the best, but you kind of expect the worst. I mean,
right.
that's how I do it, at least. But you know, it kind of makes you invincible to negativity to some degree, but.
Well, I think the movie's great, and actually I got to speak to Mr. Forrester yesterday.
Oh, what a pimp he is!
he seemed like the most genuinely nice,
oh my God,
friendly guy.
As a movie geek myself, I'm proud to say that I'm friends with Robert and have been for half a decade now. So you did
your previous film, Wild Seven. featured Robert, I'm wondering, when you look at the features that you've made, because there have been three features thus far, right?
Yeah.
Trip Out was your first. How do you assess your own growth? How do you think you're growing as a writer, director, as an artist?
Well, I think Trip Out was my first, and I have a deep affection for that, just because You know, it, for me, films are kind of bookmarks for me. And you know, that was the beginning of, and it means a lot to me. Wild 7 was the one where I fumbled the ball a lot of times, trying to bite off more than I could chew, thematically and story wise, and you know, in a lot of other ways. I thought to say that I would do them differently, but I definitely learned from many, many mistakes. And Calamity, I'm happy with all around. I mean, I feel like it's really the first time where it came out how intended to.
Yeah, and you have a couple of projects in development right now, right?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. Both of which I'm excited about.
And do you have a kind of a timetable of when you want to start your next one?
Well, I mean,
as soon as possible.
Yeah. I mean, I can rewrite under the gun if need be. So, I mean, one of the screenplays I've actually been working on for 4 or 5 years, and I mean, rewriting, and I just finished the other one at the end of September. I'm excited about that, too. So,
yeah.
They're both, if I could make either one of those, then I'd be very happy.
Well, I wish you the best of luck with getting those off the ground. I can't wait to see more work from you. I wanted, before I let you go, I just want to ask a fun question. Since you're obviously a movie geek like I am, if you were to list, you know, three to five of your favorite movies that you'd recommend to anyone to kind of show, this is who I am, this is what represents me and what I think is the best of cinema, what would those titles be?
Ooh, that's tough. You know, that's a tough one. I'll do my best. I'd have to say maybe Magnolia. This one makes me sound like a big dork, but Battle Royale, the special edition, not the original shorter cut, but the lengthened cut. Let me see. I mean, I do love our Park Chan-wook and anything, Old Boy, I guess. Let me see. With a friend like Harry.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen that before?
Yes.
I'm trying my best to come up with good valid stuff here. Let me dig up one more. I mean, I really love all kinds of films. I don't, you know, Cinema Paradiso. There's another one. I really love.
In terms of directors, filmmakers, who do you think has had the most influence and impact on you?
I don't know. I'm starting to feel like, you know, I felt like after Calamity was all said and done, I felt like, you know, trying to dig back and think about my inspiration, but I feel like Twin Peaks had a strong effect on it, because I don't want to say what happens in the movie, but you know, with what happens with the character Ashley, that sort of reminded me of elements of that. After,
mm-hmm.
But as far as the director, I'm really into and I'm not going to pronounce these horribly wrong, but Dominic Moll, who did with Friend Like Harry, and
mm-hmm.
really like. I think it's Ole Bornedal, or who did Night Watch and the remake of Night Watch, and then a movie I really, really actually kind of liked a lot called The Substitute that came out last year. I don't know. I really love all directors for different reasons. So,
well, it's funny that you mentioned Twin Peaks, because we were talking to Robert yesterday about David Lynch. And
he told me that story today.
Yeah, and about the similarity between the two of you, because you both, and you can see it plain as day in Calamity too. I mean, it's really thinking outside the box. Like we said before, it's not derivative of anything. I'm always surprised to find out that David Lynch has seen anyone else's movies, because his movies are so like singular, you know. They don't remind you of any other work.
Yeah, yeah. I feel the same way about Lynch. I've watched his films. I'm a fan of his, but I've watched his films before and just like, oh my god, like I see these films and then I see his Twitter page talking about the weather outside in LA and I'm just like who the hell is this guy?
Who is this guy? Yeah, yeah. Well, James, I'm crazy about your movie and I can't wait to see other movies from you, my friend. Thank you so much for giving me your time.
Thank you very much and thank you for being such a nice, thoughtful interviewer as far as all this stuff goes. It's been a great pleasure to talk to you.